The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback.
Hey, everybody. It's Elisa Stoddard, the Executive Director for the Utah Chapter. Hey, I have a really terrific opportunity for Utah Chapter members. We are looking to recruit about 7 more practices to participate in a national quality improvement project aimed to increase adolescent immunization rates. Practices will have access to subject matter experts, QI coaching, monthly data reports, data collection tool, and additional resources. Project incentives will include MLC Part 2, and 4, and CME credit. In addition, we will be offering a $1,000 stipend per practice upon successful completion. You can find more information on our website, aapUtah.org, under programs, under IIRA, or you can email me at elisa@aapUtah.org. We need to recruit people by the end of August 2020. Now on to the Q&A.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We've been fortunate this month to hear lots of great stuff about gastroenterology from Dr. Justin Wheeler. We're very happy to have him back today to deal with your questions. Welcome back, Justin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I know you've been on service, so you're probably tired, but do you have any conflicts that you want to report?
No conflicts have been gained over the last 3 weeks since I first showed up here, so unfortunately still no conflicts of interest.
Are you fishing for conflicts?
I didn't fish too much.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll try to keep it conflict-free tonight. We have a couple of questions that have come in that we hope you can enlighten us about. First one, how much caution should we feel about using PEG-3350 in children? There have been reports both in the popular and professional press about the risks of long-term use in children, about contamination with ethylene glycol and diethylene glycol. Yeah, it's been so helpful in keeping stools soft. Should I feel cautious?
Yeah, good question. This is a question that I first heard as a resident and has come up multiple times throughout my somewhat short professional career. And I don't think it's necessarily going to go away right away, but there is some really good research going on right now that hopefully will help put this question to rest to some degree. It's a really valid question that we should ask. Is any medicine that we're giving, is it causing harm or is it doing more harm than good? The doctors that I worked with as a fellow and now as an attending who practiced in the pre-polyethylene glycol days have shared how much of a game changer it was, really, to have it available. I started practicing after Miralax or polyethylene glycol was already on the market, so I didn't personally experience that. Maybe you can...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is a huge game changer. Trying to get kids to take mineral oil? Oh, holy cow, that was not good.
Right, and a lot of the other medicines that are available for treating constipation have a side effect profile that's challenging. So lactose, for example, can cause bloating and is cloyingly sweet and sometimes hard to get kids to take. And other medicines like milk of magnesia or magnesium citrate similarly can be unpalatable or be challenging to get children to ingest. And as we always say, the medicine that's sitting on the counter, it doesn't work for treating constipation.
Right,
it has to be in the patient. So with polyethylene glycol, it's a tasteless powder for the most part. Sometimes patients will report a plasticky flavor, sometimes maybe from the packaging that it's been a while. Or else they might notice the gritty flavor if it's not dissolved really well. But for the most part, it's pretty well tolerated. It doesn't have too many side effects in most patients. The hard thing with any medicine in pediatrics is typically the drug labeling that's put out there and what they do the testing for is pretty limited. You know, they don't necessarily explore really long-term use to get their FDA approval and to start marketing it. So you'll notice on the packaging, it often says, if you're going to use this medicine for longer than 7 to 14 days, or if you're under a certain age, you need to discuss this with your healthcare provider. From the experience of pediatric GI doctors and pediatricians over the last 20 years that Miralax has really readily been available, polyethylene glycol has been on the market, the prevailing experience is that it's pretty well tolerated with minimal side effects. The side effects that do come up, though, are these questions of is there a chance that you're getting exposed to contaminants that could be causing side effects? It has been reported by patients of negative side effects when taking it. Some of the most common side effects are neuropsychiatric changes or behavior changes that parents report. The behavior changes, as I've talked with some parents and some providers, might be related not as much just to the medicine, but something to think about and talk about with parents is it can be a change in what the patient is experiencing. Many of the children who or parents who reported challenges with this might be in kids, for example, who have autism, who've had really refractory constipation for a long time. They go on Miralax and parents report changes in behavior. And it might be because these children, they can't control a lot of what's going on around them, but they can control their bowels. And suddenly when you lose that ability to control your bowels, you're no longer able to withhold because it's so loose. It can be disconcerting and kids might become more aggressive, for example, or they might be acting out more. And so that potentially could be a side effect. But to address, is there a chance that there are negative side effects? The Pediatric Professional Society called NASPGHAN, North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterologists and Hepatologists. It's really a mouthful to say.
Yes, it is.
That's our acronym. They've been doing a large multi-center study trying to evaluate and determine, is this something that we should be giving our kids or not? And so far, the preliminary data all looks pretty reassuring that the side effect profile of this is really not any more dangerous than any other stool softener. And interestingly, one of the groups started examining the effect of social media and reporting in popular media on television and things like that of negative outcomes, associating that with reports of negative side effects. And they published this paper, I think just last year, but they were able to show that I think February of 2017 is when there was kind of this big popular spike in discussions about polyethylene glycol, if it was safe or not. And the FDA had more than a five-fold increase in that 1 month alone in reports of adverse effects. And then subsequently, that number just dropped right back down to the baseline. Mm-hmm. So talking about it being present in social media and in television seemed to make people be on the lookout for this. And you had this momentary spike, but that almost immediately went away and kind of burned out. The side effects that they showed were things like anxiety, depression, nervousness, and then some psychiatric things like paranoia, self-injury, confusion, headbanging, things like that. And so it wasn't necessarily something that you would right away ascribe to polyethylene glycol, but it could be there. There was certainly this association, temporal association, with it being out on popular media and then people reporting side effects and that really going away. Interestingly, it also corresponded with internet searches for side effects of Miralax for the same time. And this paper, we can post a link to it maybe, or people can refer to it. But
it'd be great.
Several providers, GI providers at a variety of institutions, and it was published in Gastroenterology and Hepatology. 2019 is when it was published. So it's a good paper to look at, and maybe you can refer families to. But that association of sometimes when you hear about it and think about it, you might be ascribing side effects to it that may or may not actually bear out. To summarize, the ongoing large multi-center studies are ongoing, where we're looking for side effects and negative side effects from this medicine. In general, I feel very comfortable prescribing it to my patients, and I use it in my patients and even for long-term amounts of time. If families are concerned about using it, you can share that it has been used for many, 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 many patients, and the number of adverse events over a 10-year period in pediatric patients was limited to about 650 children out of thousands and thousands and thousands that were treated with it, that were reported. And most of them were more related to behavior as opposed to anything that was causing long-term injury to the kids. And that there should be a really great multi-center study coming out pretty quickly here that you can refer to, hopefully in the next year or two, that so far, at least on preliminary data, seems to support that it's a safe medicine to use.
So cautiously should feel okay about using it.
I think so. I think we should feel okay about using it. Obviously, the most thing is working with families. And if a family is concerned about it, it's totally valid to have the conversation. And there's always just offer other options. You know, we can always offer some of those other medicines that we talked about, lactulose, docusate, milk of magnesia, magnesium citrate, things like that. There's other options out there.
Good. Question number two. And this is, I think, an especially apt question for you. Are the emperor of motility, are you not?
Emperor is a strong word. I take maybe Duke. We did
Duke of motility.
No, but yeah. I am the motility guy here at Primary Children's. So yes.
So I was thinking Czar of motility was probably a better choice. Do we know much about whether constipation, irritable bowel syndrome persists into adulthood in our patients? Is this a long-term management problem or something that patients get over? And I was referring to the motility part about that because there does seem to be some part about this that's related to dysmotility or perhaps to slow transit. You could certainly enlighten us about that. Are these long-term wiring issues or are they things that people get over?
The good news is the vast majority of kids who have functional GI disorders, abdominal pain, functional constipation, get better. So they've done some pretty good long-term studies, and over 60% of patients, probably 70% of patients, of pediatric patients, get better in a fairly short amount of time. At five-year follow-up, 30% might still have some symptoms. So the vast majority of kids will get better, and it proves with time. The risk factors for it not getting better do exist. So there are some children who might struggle with this long term, and it might be a chronic problem that waxes and wanes in intensity. The link between the brain and the belly that we talked about before seems to play a big role in this. So some of the studies that they've looked at, prospective studies, have shown that children who have significant anxiety or depression or have had longer standing symptoms or earlier age of onset are more likely to have longer term struggles. That extends into teenage years or into adulthood. The patients who have a family history of GI disorders, who have parents who have significant somatic problems, somatic symptoms like chronic headaches, chronic pain, oftentimes you see that persist in children. The same families will have this persistence of symptoms. And so for long-term care, for when you talk about prognosis, overall the prognosis is good, but there will be a subsection of kids who will struggle. One of the things that I've seen in my practice is that if you can control symptoms early and you can get both the patient and the parent to kind of understand the biopsychosocial aspect of pain and of how to treat that pain, that it's not just one medicine's gonna make it go away, but instead it might be significant lifestyle changes and learning coping mechanisms and things like that, you'll often see that they do the best out of all children, even if they come in with very severe symptoms. Patients who have a hard time embracing that or kind of come from get that reinforcement of the sick role, oftentimes have a harder time changing. You see that persist over a long period of time. Irritable bowel syndrome, it does seem to be worse in the teenage years. There does seem to be some sort of hormonal link in some patients, not all patients, but some patients, some studies have shown that. And so sometimes getting through puberty, the teenage years, kids get maybe change what's going on in the living situation. They get out of the house. Maybe that's part of it. They get over the hormones. They get over the stressors of high school. And sometimes you'll see and they also learn to identify their triggers and how to avoid them. And a lot of times you see symptoms really start to improve as they move into more young adulthood. And it it seems to dry up to some degree.
Very helpful. Well, thank you again so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us. This is such a valuable topic, and we really appreciate the time that you've spent. Anything else you want to share before we say goodbye for now?
Maybe a couple of things I'll address real quickly. You know, there are kids out there who, that you know, they're evaluated by the pediatrician, and the pediatrician's done a bang-up job with really covering all the bases and getting kids, you know, addressing kind of the concerns and doing the appropriate workup, and it's still persistent, and they might get referred to a gastroenterologist. And even then, sometimes you run into kids where it's really just quite refractory, and families are really looking for alternative treatment options and therapies, either for severe constipation or for severe abdominal pain. And so there are programs here at Primary Children's where we can offer some extra things that maybe not every child needs, but could be helpful for some.
Oh, that's great.
Do you mind if I talk about those?
No, that's great. That's great.
Okay. One of the programs is put together by the Colorectal Center here. It's under the direction of Dr. Michael Rollins, who's a colorectal surgeon. He put it together, and it's been running for several years. And it's for kids with really severe constipation, where they do an aggressive bowel management program, where kids might either go on high-dose laxative therapy under the direction and oversight of nurse practitioners and doctors and a nursing team, and adjust those doses of either high-dose laxatives or do a large volume enema therapy for a period of time, where kids might actually get an enema every single day for a period of time to allow them to get some confidence back in their ability to make it to the bathroom on time, stay clean and not soil. And so for kids out there who are really, really struggling with constipation, who haven't responded to the typical clean out with Miralax or polyethylene glycol or similar laxatives like we talked about in our prior episodes, a referral in to see a GI doctor or ultimately maybe from a GI doctor to the colorectal program, where either myself or one of those other providers sees them, could be a really good answer. So if you feel like you're floundering out there and you do need some help, just be aware that that program exists. It's called the CHARM Clinic. So it stands for Constipation, Hirschsprung's Disease, and Anorectal Malformations. So CHARM Clinic is a great resource.
How do people access the CHARM Clinic?
It's through Primary Children's. Oftentimes it requires a referral from a provider. So if you have questions, you can always reach out to Primary Children's, just the main line, and they can direct you in the right direction. And similarly with motility issues, if we have children who have had refractory feeding intolerance or refractory pain in our motility clinic, we see those kids who kind of run the gamut of things. And we typically just ask that they are referred by a GI doctor or maybe a complex care provider first, and then on to us. Another thing that we have that's kind of a newer treatment modality for functional abdominal pain that's kind of neat is peripheral nerve field stimulation. So there's been a push in years from families, and I think from providers too, to find treatments for kids that are non-medical, a way to treat a child that is not going to be a medicine that has side effects, but is seems to have some efficacy and has some evidence behind its use. And there's this theory, it's called a peripheral nerve, this device, peripheral nerve field stimulation device is what it's called, was used for opioid withdrawal, actually. This device is something where you have, it looks almost like a hearing aid that goes right behind the ear, has tiny little electrodes that are placed on the ear. And in theory, we've done some studies in mice looking at this, but in theory, this device sends out little electrical stimulation and it activates the peripheral nerve fields of the cranial nerves. And those tracks pass right through the centers of the brain associated with chronic pain. So the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. And those areas, it seems that with this device, seem to distract the belly from the pain. So it's sending out little pulses, and over a 3 or 4 week period, there's enough distraction that perhaps the child's perception of pain really diminishes and their ability to function seems to really improve. So there's a study published in The Lancet a couple of years ago looking at this, and there's current multi-center ongoing studies evaluating the efficacy in kids with chronic abdominal pain, but it's been FDA cleared for use in kids ages 12 to 18 who have functional abdominal pain associated with irritable bowel syndrome. And they did a sham control trial where people had the device on, and it was significantly better outcomes than placebo or the sham. And so it's a new thing. It's not readily available necessarily to all comers, but it is nice to know that there are new treatment modalities coming out that we can offer our kids in the future that might be an alternative to throwing another pill at them, in addition to all the other things that are super important, like lifestyle change, mm-hmm. you're getting a good diet, a good rest, and those kinds of things. Certainly not a panacea or a cure-all to make this go away, but the reports of early outcomes of using this device seems to be helpful. So it's something that we're exploring here at Primary Children's and offering to very few select families at kind of early stages of it. But it is nice to know that things like that are out there. And we can always post a link to that study that was published in The Lancet too, if people are interested in learning about it.
Well, it sounds like a real nice thing for some people who are just especially miserable and we haven't been able to fix it otherwise.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think the take-home message is that if you have a patient who's just really been having a hard time feeling better, you're kind of stuck at a dead end, feel free to send them our way. We're happy to help out. And there's a lot of treatment options out there, and there's no one-size-fits-all kind of approach to these kids. But again, at the end of the day, the vast majority get better, and hopefully that's promising to families and to patients.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you so much, and we look forward to collaborating with you in the future. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.